This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On Monday, the Washington Post published a story that revealed a complaint to the Internal Revenue Service by a former employee of the investment arm of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The man, named David Nielsen, was identified as a whistleblower. He had been an investment manager for the company called Ensign Peak Advisors. The paper revealed Nielsen had filed a confidential document with the IRS back in November. In it, he said the church had used surplus tithing money and other member contributions to stockpile a staggeringly big investment portfolio, $100 billion. Nielsen and his twin brother Lars, who helped him write the complaint, say the fund breaks federal tax rules. The money, which is exempt from being taxed because it's associated with a religious institution, is supposed to be used for something, for charity or education or some other good deed. It's not supposed to just sit there, growing bigger and bigger, which Nielsen says it is. For more than 20 years now, it has grown mostly untouched. And the two times it was used in the past wasn't for the poor or to aid in some natural disaster, but to prop up a pair of for-profit business ventures. That, too, the brothers say, violates tax law. So today in the program, we're talking about this story and the questions it raises, not just about the technicalities of tax law, but the appropriateness of stockpiling so much money and the church's obligation to its members. Joining us first is John Swain. He's a reporter with The Washington Post. He's the lead investigator on the story, and he joined us this morning from the offices of The Post in Washington. John Swain, how did this story first come to you?
The story first came to us at The Post because a tip came in to kind of channels that we maintain here for that kind of thing. An editor here at The Post began communicating with the tipster and then brought reporters onto the story as a team to start looking into it, to start communicating with the source, and to start checking the things that we were being told. And so it really came to The Post. It wasn't something that we were out there looking for. And it developed from there.
What were your initial impressions of the significance of the story?
I think my initial impressions were that this was a very large sum of money that was being talked about. Mm-hmm. This was an unusually large amount of money for a charity to be dealing in. It was an incredibly detailed set of allegations that were being made about this money, about this fund. And that I believe deserved or warranted further scrutiny.
I think people have a sense of the basics of the story by now, but I wanted to go through what this is about. And so the argument is that the LDS Church has this, I think it's fair to say, massive pool of money, if the details here are right, set aside in an account that, as far as anyone can tell, is just sitting there and has been sitting there for more than 20 years now, not really being used except in two kind of extraordinary circumstances. But those are the basics. It has this big fund of money that's just there, I guess.
That's correct. And this is essentially an investment firm, just like there are investment firms in the private sector. But the thing that's different about this one is that it is registered as part of the church. And because in the United States, churches and religious organizations are exempt largely from income tax. That means that this investment firm, as part of the church, can bring in money, can bring in profits and returns on its investments tax-free. And it's been doing that, as you say, for some 22 years, and it's been bringing in billions and billions of dollars and not having to pay tax on it. And as you mentioned, the money has been sitting there, as far as we can tell, accumulating interest, accumulating more returns, and accumulating more money from members of the church. And as we say, it's grown to an extraordinary sum, to some $100 billion.
Put that in perspective, if you could, just how much money. I mean, that's a lot, but how does that compare to the other pools of money in other institutions? I mean, you mentioned in your article Microsoft and Apple and Harvard University's big endowment.
That's right. So some of the world's biggest companies, such as Microsoft and Apple, they've come under some criticism for accumulating cash. And the amounts that we're talking about with those companies are in the same ballpark, $100 to $120 billion for them. So this kind of sum really puts the LDS Church among some of the biggest companies and the wealthiest people in the world.
I have to say, around here, the headquarters of the LDS Church, one of the things that's been so striking is that we actually have a number. Now, whether it's entirely accurate or not, I guess is something to talk about. But for decades, as you mentioned, the church has been secretive about its finances. So to have actual numbers in the public has been interesting and kind of striking. And you mentioned in your story that the apparent fortune of the church, I guess, far exceeds the guesses of people over the years.
That's right. It has been very difficult for analysts and for journalists and people who've been looking at the church to put any kind of number on its wealth confidently, because it's been met with some privacy and secrecy. This is the first time that we're aware of that internal documents from the church enterprises, from this Ensign Peak Advisors branch of the church, have been made public. And with those documents, which set out in some detail where this money is parked, what investments it holds, we were able to extrapolate figures for current investments that the church has to around $100 billion.
So give us a sense of how this works for the LDS Church, as far as you've been able to concern. The complaint says the church gets about $7 billion a year from tithing and other contributions. And $6 billion of that goes to operating costs. But the other billion, it goes to Ensign Peak Advisors.
This is what the whistleblower's complaint alleges to the IRS, that, as you say, about $1 billion or so, sometimes more, is left over essentially at the end of every year after costs are met. And that money is plowed into this investment company, Ensign Peak Advisors, which then can use that money to infuse that money into its investments, to buy stocks, to buy bonds, to buy partnerships in private equity companies and things like that. And in doing that, it then continues to make more money every year. Money makes more money, and over 22 years, when you start with a few billion dollars, it soon starts climbing to tens of billions of dollars.
Why is that money exempt from taxes?
It's exempt from taxes because churches and religious organizations for decades have been exempt from income tax. They are seen by the government, it's agreed by society, if you like, that they serve a charitable public purpose. They are out there not to make profits, not to make money, but to improve the lives of their members. And so churches and religious organizations have always had this exemption. What's new in more recent years is that churches and religious organizations have really diversified what they're doing. Some of them have created these investment companies and other sort of business ventures, as we would recognize them, in order to further the church's wealth. They've been making money for the church, and the church says, well, we're using this money to further our church ambitions and our mission, and therefore that money should also be free from tax because it's, if you like, part of the wider church mission and operation. And that's sort of relatively controversial because essentially, these organizations have started to compete with private organizations that do have to pay tax.
At the center of the story, of course, is Ensign Peak Advisors, this investment division. What do we know about this division, this organization? You mentioned it sounds like a pretty secretive organization as far as we can tell.
That's right. Until now, we knew it existed. It had been mentioned in some public reporting, but it had always been termed quite secretive and quite unknown. And what we're told by this whistleblower, David Nielsen, is that it had an internal level of secrecy where executives and staff were walled off from information that wasn't in their kind of need-to-know area, that there were strict non-disclosure agreements pushed on staff where they were asked to not talk about what they were working on. Sometimes people were asked to sign agreements that their heirs would also be bound by non-disclosure agreements.
Wow.
And so the picture that's painted by this whistleblower complaint is an organization that tried very hard to contain its information and contain data about its investments and about the amount of money it was dealing in.
So I want to come back to the whistleblower himself, because often when you hear that term, it refers to someone who wants to remain anonymous. In this case, of course, we know who's making the complaint. It's a man named David Nielsen. I guess, first of all, what do we know about him?
What we know is that he's a 41-year-old finance professional based in Salt Lake City. He started working for Ensign Peak Advisors in September 2010. He actually left Ensign Peak Advisors earlier this year, at the start of September. And by all accounts, he was a successful and very clever and good employee. He has, in recent years, I think, started to slightly move away from the church. Members of his family have, and so he felt the need to spend more time with family members who were not part of the church. But we know he's very bright. He's a university graduate. He has an MBA, and he's an experienced financial professional.
Why did he leave in September? Your reporting mentions that his wife and his children had become disaffected from the church. He thought that, since he was working for a church organization, would be problematic. But did he also express at the time that he was concerned about the fact that there was $100 billion pool of money that was just sitting there that he thought was inappropriately being looked after?
Well, according to his complaint, he raised concerns about that throughout his time at the company. Yeah. Over several years, he says he confronted his managers and his bosses to say, what are we doing here? I thought when I joined that we were making money to use for church purposes, to help the poor, to build temples, to do things like that. And he was told, well, it hasn't been revealed to us what this money is intended for yet, and we just have to keep accumulating it. When it came to his departure from the church, we've seen a resignation from Ensign Peak Advisors, a letter he submitted at the end of August, in which he said that members of his family were moving away from the church. He wanted to spend more time with them, essentially, and he felt he couldn't give a 100% commitment to the church. He asked them, would that be okay? Could we come to an accommodation? And he was essentially told no. To continue to work for Ensign Peak Advisors, he would have to be a full, committed, 100% committed member of the church. Mm-hmm. And indeed, they told him that if he were not, that could distract colleagues from their work. And so the company decided that he should leave, and he offered to work another month. They said, maybe you should go now. Here's a payout, and you can keep your health insurance. It wasn't an angry departure. He wasn't marched out of the building or anything like that. But there had come a point where he had diverged from the company.
Yeah. We should point out that there's another Nielsen in the story. It's David's twin brother, Lars. Talk about the role he's played in this story.
That's right. David and Lars are twin brothers. Lars helped David put together his complaint for the IRS. Lars was writing much of it with input from David, with research David had done and documents David had produced from his time working for Ensign Peak Advisors. And it was Lars that actually went public with it. He came to the Washington Post. And the way he describes it is that the brothers had a disagreement about the best way to proceed with this complaint. David wanted to take what you might call the inside route, to stay private, to tell the IRS and keep it secret and to go that way. Lars thought that it was more urgent that the public know what this complaint contained. And so Lars made the decision to go public without David. And we haven't been able to speak with David. He's declined to talk with the press so far. And so Lars has become, the public driving force of this complaint.
They're not exactly on the same page about that then yet, although I've heard Lars since say that he thinks they can work it out. They haven't become disaffected as brothers, but they just don't agree on the strategy for getting this information out. They do believe it should be public. It's just, I guess, how to make that happen is the dispute, I suppose.
That's exactly right. Lars stresses that was really the only disagreement, that David wanted to play the long and steady, potentially years-long method of getting this complaint to the IRS and trust that would be the best way to settle the problem. Lars thought that was too long. It could take years. It could end with a kind of private settlement that people weren't aware of. And they just went their separate ways for the time being.
So, John Swain, I wanted to ask you about what's wrong with having a big pile of money and having it just sit there if you're a religious organization. You hired a former IRS official to help you work through the rules, the propriety of all of this. What did Philip Hackney was his name. What did he tell you? What's wrong with all of this?
What Philip Hackney told us is that for a branch of a church like this to maintain its tax-exempt status, it needs to be doing some charitable work. It needs to be not hoarding money. It needs to be putting some of that money to charitable use. And if for 22 years, as this complaint alleges, Ensign Peak Advisors has been stockpiling money rather than using any of it for charitable purposes, Philip Hackney says that that's a problem. There is also a separate second problem alleged in this whistleblower complaint, which is that the two withdrawals that have been made from Ensign Peak Advisors went to for-profit ventures associated with the church. And Hackney tells us that too would be a problem because, if you like, you can't use money that has been exempted from tax to then prop up companies that are in the for-profit and taxable realm. And so those two things really are what Hackney identifies as potentially problematic for the church.
And those two outputs, one of them was to prop up, and both of the – one of them was to prop up an insurance firm, Beneficial Insurance, when they were suffering some problems during the financial crisis. The other was to prop up a shopping mall, a local shopping mall here in town that the church funded. Those are the two entities there, and they put a lot of money in there. One was the mall was more than $1 billion. The help for the insurance company was something approaching $600 million.
That's correct. So these two withdrawals that David Nielsen says he identified while he was working at Ensign Peak totaled about $2 billion, which, given that he says they were the only withdrawals, that is quite striking. And I think another thing that's quite striking that the whistleblower complaint alleges and notes, if you like, because it is correct, the church stressed at the time to members that no tithing money would be used to pay for this shopping mall, this City Creek shopping center, which is particularly sort of brilliant shopping center with a retractable roof. It's a very state-of-the-art complex, and it costs a lot of money. There was some disquiet at the time from members about, you know, their tithing money being used to pay for it. And the church said, don't worry, essentially, we're not going to use your tithing money. And David Nielsen says in his complaint that that wasn't true. Mm-hmm. Tithing money came into Ensign Peak Advisors and went out again to pay for this shopping mall. And as you say, the second output, if you like, was to Beneficial Life Insurance Company, which struggled due to its exposure to mortgage-backed securities during the financial crisis. And the complaint alleges that about $600 million went from Ensign Peak to bail out that company. And the church gave a different story to members about that as well. And so the complaint basically says the church has misled members about the destination of their tithing money.
You sent a detailed list of questions to the church. What kind of response did you get?
We did send a detailed list of questions because this is a complicated issue. We wanted to give the church the opportunity to engage with us on every single point and to say where they might disagree with our understanding. But unfortunately, we didn't get any substantive response at all. We, at the end of the day, got a more general explanation from the church about its decision to hold some financial reserves and a more general statement from the church that it stood by its financial practices and that it paid all taxes that it was expected to pay, which was disappointing because, you know, we always want to get proper answers to specific questions so that we can make sure every claim from, in this case, the whistleblower complaint can be answered by the subject. The following day, the church issued a statement that people may have seen, mm-hmm. in which it, again, didn't address any specific allegations or didn't correct any specific claims from the whistleblower complaint or our reporting. But it tried to stress that this was based on what it called limited information and from, you know, one perspective. So we still hope that the church will engage on the questions and perhaps give more detailed information to its members and to us.
One of the questions that comes up in your story is just what the church is actually spending compared to what it apparently could be spending. So you quote a church senior elder, this was back in 2016, who said that over the past 30 years, the church had spent $40 million every year on humanitarian aid and other various welfare projects, which is a lot of money. That's remarkably generous, of course, but $40 million out of what is alleged to be about $1 billion a year is a tiny fraction of that. And that was an interesting, I think, revelation for some in the article.
I think that's right, and I think that's one point that the Nielsen brothers dwell on, mm-hmm. if you like, is that they believe that given that this money is coming in, it should be put to good use, that there are people in need out there. There are members of the church who are struggling all around the world in different countries. You know, obviously there are members of the church who are in poverty. There are members in Africa who are struggling with poverty. And so the Nielsen brothers say, you know, why is this money not being put to good use rather than sitting there?
The church said in a statement that setting aside this big portion of money is a sound doctrinal and financial principle taught by Jesus Christ. The statement says that the fund is a prudent reserve for the future. But that same elder also mentioned a few years later that the church's financial strategy was linked to what he called prophecies about the last days. Let's talk a little bit about what you think that might mean. In the whistleblower complaint itself, the report says that the president of Ensign, a man named Roger Clark, said the money would be used in the event of the second coming of Christ. So this gives you a sense that the church has in mind for that money something much, much later. Or what do you know about that or understand about that part?
Well, our understanding from the whistleblower complaint, as you say, is that top executives at Ensign Peak Advisors apparently did talk in these terms, in these almost apocalyptic terms of needing this money for the end times or for the second coming or just for a day in the undetermined future that couldn't yet be seen. And so that is in keeping, as you say, with sort of speeches that have been given by top executives in the church about needing reserves for the end times. That, as is well known, the church is very prudent in keeping grain silos and emergency warehouses stocked with goods and food. And likewise, the church says in public remarks, not connected to our story, but previously, that it needs to keep some of its money back as a reserve as well. And so that, if you like, that is true. That is in keeping with what the church has said about being careful to keep some money back. I think it's fair to say that many people didn't expect it to be quite so much money.
Well, and it comes back to, I guess, the legal question that you explore in the article. Is it legal for the LDS Church to keep this much money, $100 billion in a fund for the second coming of Jesus Christ?
Well, I think the church and many defenders of the church that we've heard from say that, yes, it is legal and it's okay because the law around this is not precise. And sometimes the IRS has to deal with things on a case-by-case basis. And their argument is that the church should be trusted to accumulate this money, to keep it safe for the future, essentially. And the church should be trusted to say, as they do, that it's doing good works, and that by accumulating this money, one day it will use that money for good works, and one day it could be needed by people in need, people struggling, members who need that money. What critics of the church would say is that it should be used much sooner, mm-hmm. that if you are legally avoiding tax on money coming in, at some point more immediate than the never-never, that money should be used for charitable works. And so, you know, there is no completely clear, sharp rules on this that the IRS can point to, because it's a matter of debate. But I think that the IRS is going to have to look at this complaint and decide where it comes down.
Finally, how long do you figure something like this will take to play out, to adjudicate? This is a sort of multi-year process, I suppose.
That's our understanding as well. These things can take a long, long time. The IRS obviously might decide from a fairly prompt account of the complaint that it isn't interested in looking at that, but it might decide that it is. And so we're just going to have to wait and see. I think these things can take years. They can enter into negotiations with organizations to decide that actually you should have been paying money on this portion of your income or that portion of your income. But I think, yes, people are going to have to be patient and wait for the IRS to take its time. As an auxiliary of the church, Ensign Peak Advisors can be audited by the IRS. Churches themselves cannot be. Mm. And so the IRS does have tools at its disposal to look into the finances of Ensign Peak and come to a conclusion about whether it's been operating properly.
John Swain, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's John Swain. He's part of the reporting team covering this story for The Washington Post. He joined us from the paper's office in Washington. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
If you're a KUER supporter, you can manage your donation with MyKUER. Use our online system to update your contact information, adjust your contribution, send us a message, or change your billing info. It's the place to go when your credit card expires, or you have to replace it because you left it at a restaurant. To sign up, look for MyKUER under the Support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the fallout from the revelations of a whistleblower whose complaint to the IRS was revealed this week by The Washington Post. In it, he says the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints built up a massive investment portfolio. We're talking $100 billion, if that's accurate, with money that was supposed to go or could have gone to charity. We should also mention we reached out to the LDS Church to join us for the program. They declined an interview. They did share information from LDS.org regarding their finances, as well as a statement from the First Presidency, which was issued this week in response to all of the media stories. Joining us now on the program is Lee Hale. He's KUER's religion reporter, also host of the podcast Preach. And Lee, welcome back.
Hey, Doug.
How are you reacting? Well, let me ask you this before I – what's the general reaction that you're sensing from people after this story broke? Has there been a theme?
It's split. I will say one thing that is interesting is nobody is saying that number, $100 billion, is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like everyone – I mean, it's shocking but not unbelievable. Some people react and say, well, good. Like, I'm glad that the church is investing our money and taking care of it and maybe even seeing God's hand in allowing this money to grow at an alarming rate. I mean, that's a good investment. And then others are saying, you ask an awful lot of us, members of the church, and you've been holding out on us, basically. Like this, and why stockpile? Isn't this church focused on doing good, not just for members of the church, but for the world? What could you possibly have in mind with this much money sitting around?
It seems like a lot of the reaction has been, or some of the reaction has been, big deal. Church is good at investing. So what? They came up with this big fund.
Right. Well, in the First Presidency statement, they invoke the parable of the talents. The New Testament scriptures say that Jesus the master asked the servants to invest this money that's given to them. And then he comes back and those who invested it well are praised and the one who didn't is chastened. And I think a lot of people would say that's right, that God is a doctrinal thing. God wants you to grow what he's given you. And in that way, it's like big whoop, like they're doing what they're supposed to do.
Yeah. I wonder what you made of – I want to get back to some of that. But the question of whether members were themselves misled, what's your take on that? What do rank-and-file members of this church expect from the tithing money that they give to their church?
I mean, in one sense, it's written on the tithing slip that the church will make a reasonable effort, that's the word that's used, to allocate the money to the place people have designated. For instance, you could say, I want this to go to the general church fund. I want this to go to fast offerings to feed the needy. I want this to go to the missionary fund. But basically, they're saying, we'll make a reasonable effort, but you just so you know, everything is going to the church, and the church can use it at their discretion. I don't think anyone's felt in the dark about that. That's always been the case. And clearly, that's what they're doing. They're using it at their discretion. So in that sense, I don't think people have been misled that that's an option. I think that maybe in a more Christian sense misled, that like I thought we were all about doing good, and if you're spending $40 million on humanitarian aid every year, mm-hmm. and you have $100 billion potentially to tap into
in another pile,
in
somewhere.
Another pile,
yep.
Then that doesn't feel very congruent. That seems kind of out of whack.
What did you make, and I wonder how people are reacting to just the fact that there's actually a number on the table now? When it may not be right, but the fact that the Washington Post was kind of explicit about some of the numbers that at least were alleged in this complaint, that the church collects $7 billion a year, that there's a $100 billion fund that's been amassed over all of this time. Seeing an actual number from an organization that hasn't been willing to share numbers in decades and decades is kind of intriguing or interesting.
And they haven't disputed that number.
Yeah.
I mean, they haven't confirmed it, but they haven't disputed it. And people have not been disbelieving of that number. I think that obviously what happens to the IRS will play out and will be interesting to see. But I think that the real lasting impact of the story is that you can't erase that number from people's heads. That will stick around.
Yeah.
And maybe for a lot of tithe-paying members who sustain the first presidency, that will not be an issue. But I can see a lot of people who maybe were on the fence, this might push them over. Like this might be the thing that makes them feel like I don't feel like I want to be a team player if this much is being kept from me.
We asked people to comment, and we also have been collecting some Twitter and Facebook reaction as well. Here's something from Michelle who writes, I get tithing. I get faith. I even get exercises in futility, but when I'm struggling to pay the mortgage and make ends meet at Christmas time for my 7 kids, and I think of the 6 months' worth that I just sent to the church, I get this pit in my stomach. This is just very deflating tonight. This from Eric who writes, I'm amazed at the apologists coming forward saying that it's all great fiduciary management while there are these vulnerable families and single moms and kids making sacrifices in blind faith that the windows of heaven are going to open. What are you hearing there? Just a kind of like, wow, that's a lot of money. I mean, this idea of being deflated, are you hearing a bit of that?
I am. I think that I think everyone knows that the church does take care of its own when people are in need. And so I think if somebody really, really needs something from the church, they can get it. I think that you see the squeeze kind of in people who maybe aren't destitute but are struggling to – I mean, when you look at 10% of your income, that's a big number when you write that amount. And I think that every time a member of the church makes a payment, that is an act of faith. And they're looking at that number and saying, this is worth my investment. And so that's why I think there are some people who felt that squeeze every time they look at that number, and I could see this influencing their decision in the future. Other people I think are happy to pay and have felt the blessings of heaven. I've heard many people say that tithing has blessed them, that they believe God is blessing them and allowing them to live the lifestyle they're living, the life they're living, and I can't see them being affected by that at all.
I wonder this question about how and you do have to sympathize in some ways with leaders of the church who are trying to allow for their members to sacrifice, to give this tithing, which Mormons perceive as a commandment from God.
Right.
But balance that with the fact that they have a lot of money. They probably, in technical terms, don't actually need it. Are you hearing people talk about that? Because that balance seems difficult to find.
Well, in some sense, it's just like this is a spiritual principle, right? It's almost like you are telling God that God is more important than money, right? And you are like, this is an act of faith. You're putting your money away. But then there's a practical sense, which is like, for instance, the missionary payments just went up for families, $100 a month. I think it's $500 a month now to just if you have a missionary in the field. And I think people scratch their head at that and it's like, why is that going up now? Like where was that calculation made? And that's where I think the lack of transparency can cause a little bit of anxiety, because it just seems like, well, that clearly isn't being taken into account with the investments you're making. Other little things, like we were talking about a tweet about Rosemary Card tweeted about.
Let me read it.
Okay, yeah, read it.
She said, why are grandpas and moms of 9 kids cleaning buildings at 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning if we have $100 billion?
That's another simple example of, like, this is a relatively recent thing that the church doesn't hire janitors to clean the churches regularly, and then they have to send a sign-up sheet around for people to come and clean on Saturday mornings. Some people say it's a joy to serve. Others say we can afford this. Like, this is something the church can do, and I think there's a little bit of head scratching about that.
I wanted to just ask you about the whistleblower David Nielsen himself and his brother Lars. This is an interesting part of the story. I'd actually be interested in talking to them at some point about all of this, because there are questions about what's motivating them. On one hand, there's this question about one of the things that seems to have motivated or could potentially have motivated David Nielsen is the fact that he could get a cut of a settlement.
15% to 30%.
Yeah.
Which could be a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, there's people saying, well, clearly this is what's motivating them is a cut. But it's also just the way that whistleblowing works with the IRS. This is just like they need to incentivize it somehow, or else people likely would not come forward. I've only spoken to Lars, the brother of the whistleblower, not David. Lars says that, yes, there's this potential payout. But he says what David is risking basically career-wise and socially is a huge risk as well. David still lives in Utah. I'm sure his neighborhood, his friends, are members of the church. And so there's going to be pushback from that as well.
Yeah. Let's play, in fact, that moment from your conversation with Lars Nielsen.
I'll also say this about Dave. Anyone who doubts his motivation hasn't probably taken the time to write down all of the costs and benefits associated with his chosen course of action. The costs as well as the risks are severe. They are serious. Many of them have already materialized. And if they knew those things, I think it would be harder for them to make such comments on public websites. I know who David is. I know his character. And I know what his true motivations are for doing this. And they are as true and pristine as one would hope that they would be. He has a fantastic work relationships with everyone that he has that he knows at Enzyme Peak Advisors, that he were his former employees. And he cares about them. He keeps in contact with them. They care about him. This is going to be hurtful and hard for many Mormons to swallow, and it will probably damage some professional relationships, and that's also in the cost and risks column that he has weighed into this decision. Now, there is a probability associated with a very potentially large payout. A whistleblower can get between 15 and 30% of what is totally collected by the IRS, and that includes all settlements, penalties, associated interest, etc. And David is a Wall Streeter, so people might accuse him of having purely financial motivations. But I know that they're not. I know that he's a good person. And he came to me with this information, and we created the full analysis without knowing the full extent of what the whistleblower program could give us.
As far as you can tell, do we know how David Nielsen's been reacting to the news that broke on Monday?
No, this is an interesting situation because they're twin brothers.
Yeah.
And they wrote the whistleblower complaint together.
Right.
But David, because he's involved with the complaint, is kind of lawyered up and has stayed quiet. And Lars has taken the public route.
Right.
So they kind of divide and conquer. And as best I can tell, I think that they are kind of one mind about their views of how the church has been using these funds.
If not the strategy of how to bring it public.
Right.
They don't seem to agree about that.
That's what Lars is saying, is that he went to the Post without David's explicit permission. I will say one thing that's very interesting to me is that the way that they labeled the YouTube video and both the document they shared with the public. It's called Letter to an IRS Director. Which
that'll mean something for some, but it won't for others. So explain.
Yeah. So there's a very famous letter to a CES director, Church Educational System. And that's kind of this very lengthy, I think Jeremy Reynolds is the guy who wrote it, very lengthy kind of bit by bit look at church history in a way to kind of sow doubt and help people question their belief in the LDS church. And so in that way, it puts this it attaches an agenda to something I think most members of the church will be interested in, and I think that will be a turnoff to very practicing members.
As far as I can tell, Lars Nielsen has left the church.
Yeah.
Do we know about David?
Lars says David is still a member.
Yeah. Lee Hale is with us. KUER's religion reporter, host of the podcast Preach. Joining us now is Samuel Brunson. He's a professor of law at Loyola University Chicago, the author of the book God and the IRS, Accommodating Religious Practice in United States Tax Law. And Samuel Brunson, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Your general reaction to all of this, I imagine your head is reeling from all this, these allegations and the implications and federal tax law and all of that. But just generally, how are you thinking about this story?
So in general, I think that the story is more complicated than people think it is, more complicated than they're aware that it is, because it turns out that it's happening in this area of tax law that's not completely clear. So it's a lot more gray than we want. It's neither that the church is doing – is perfectly obeying the tax law or the church is throwing the tax law away. It's more like the church here is operating in this really weird area that doesn't seem to have been operated in much up until now.
Yeah. You were pretty – in a piece that you wrote, you said to the question of whether or not the church was violating the law, you said the short answer is no. No, no, they're not. But is there a but there, I guess?
There might be a but there.
Yeah.
In general, basically the question isn't about the church. It turns out that Ensign Peak Advisors is a separate entity from the church. So the question wholly becomes the question of whether Ensign Peak Advisors qualifies as tax exempt.
Yeah.
That is, if the church had this $100 billion – and had it in-house, it was investing it itself and not using it for other purposes, there'd be no question about whether legally it could do that. You might run into the other questions about whether the church should have $100 billion, but leaving that aside, there's no question that it legally could. And if it invested it with an outside investment firm, a for-profit Wall Street fund, again, there wouldn't be a question. The real question arises because Ensign Peak Advisors, which is managing the money, itself claims tax exemption. So the
right.
question is, does it qualify as tax exempt?
Well, to qualify, the IRS says the church can transfer that tithing money to an investment fund if that money is commensurate in scope with its financial resources. Now, not getting into the weeds too much, explain what that means and whether or not the church qualifies.
So it again, it would be Ensign Peak that has to use it commensurate in scope.
Yeah.
The idea is the church is tax exempt because it's a religious organization. And that's one of the things that if that's what you do, you're tax exempt. But investing money, which is all that Ensign Peak basically seems to do, is not a tax exempt purpose. So Ensign Peak doesn't have a tax exempt purpose. But the IRS in a series of rulings has said an outside organization that earns money from some sort of business and donates basically all that money to a tax-exempt organization can nonetheless qualify as tax-exempt. But for that qualification to happen, its distributions have to be commensurate in scope with its financial resources.
Hmm.
Now, commensurate in scope, the IRS basically hasn't gone out and said what that means. So, I mean, maybe it means that the organization has to distribute 75% or 50% or 20% of its revenue. What we know, or I guess what we can fairly assume, is that making no distribution is probably not commensurate in scope.
Because one of the things that came up in our conversation earlier with John Swain was the church has said we spend tens of millions of dollars a year on charity, but none of that comes from this particular fund. It's just sitting
right.
there. And again, we don't know for sure if that the church would confirm that, but no one seems to be disputing that fact. So it's just sitting there. Is that okay? It sounds like to me you're saying no, it's not.
Well, that's where the complexity comes
yeah.
in. Because for most organizations, that wouldn't be okay. Most what are called supporting organizations. But the IRS has some rulings that suggests that if a supporting organization is an integral part of a tax-exempt organization, that it may be able to use all of the activities of the organization together with the activities of the exempt of the supporting organization. So again, if Ensign Peak Advisors, if they are sitting on this $100 billion fund, and basically they get about $1 billion a year and invest it, mm-hmm. and you combine that with the expenditures of the main church itself, which it sounds like the church is spending about $6 billion a year, give or take, mm-hmm. then the commensurate in scope may not really apply. And if you can combine the two, and it's not clear that you can, but it's at least possible that you can, then you don't have a commensurate in scope problem because you have the exemption of Ensign Peak Advisors is related to the exemption of the church. And then you have even an additional wrinkle, which is that Ensign Peak Advisors is not only a supporting organization, but it's what's called an integrated auxiliary. And not to bore people with what that means, but it's something specific to churches. And it's not clear whether the commensurate in scope rule applies to integrated auxiliaries.
Wow.
And that's not to say that it doesn't, because it certainly could. Just this hasn't been an issue that the IRS has ever addressed.
Yeah, we just don't know. Yeah.
There's two things I think that I hear come up a lot, and I want to clarify with you, Sam, just to make sure I understand this right. People bring up charitable donations, and they bring up humanitarian almost like they're synonymous. But really, if Ensign Peak was just giving money to the church to spend for church needs, that would qualify under the a charitable donation.
Right. That would qualify as a commensurate in scope donation. In fact, theoretically, that's what it should be doing if it's subject to these rules.
Right.
So it doesn't have to be a humanitarian thing. It could just be a church expense, right?
It can just give whatever the number we come up with, $1 billion a year back to the church. And if that's commensurate in scope, that counts toward that requirement.
What about to this question? Because this has come up, that one of the reasons that the church is squirreling this money away is because it's saving it for the last days, for the second coming. I mean, that was an actual contention made in the complaint. Is that a good excuse that, well, we're not spending it right now because we're saving it for the latter days?
I'd say two things to that. The first is it's not really a tax-relevant excuse. If Ensign Peak Advisors doesn't have to make these commensurate in scope distributions, doesn't, whether it's saving for the second coming or it's saving for a stock market crash or it's saving because it just doesn't know what to do with the money. If it is, the IRS isn't going to look at questions of religious motivation. So whatever the church is, whatever Ensign Peak Advisors is keeping the money for isn't super relevant. If it has to make these distributions, it has to make the distributions. If it doesn't have to make the distributions, then it can be saving for the second coming or for whatever else it wants to.
You say that this is something to the question of should they have. Now, this is another matter. Should they have a $100 billion? You say this is something the institutional church should actually be grappling with. What do you mean?
I mean, I hope that it is. $100 billion, I think, has been what really grabbed people's attention because that's an enormous number. And I don't think that anyone would argue or anyone would reasonably argue that exempt organizations, including churches, shouldn't be able to have some sort of endowment, some sort of savings. We know that charitable need is countercyclical. So in downturns, when presumably charities are getting less donations, that's when they have the most need and the most need to spend. So it makes sense that they should be able to save some amount of money. And from a tax perspective, I'm outside of a tax perspective.
But this is some amount of money.
This is definitely some amount of money. And, you know, it feels like a whole lot of money to me. But I say that, and the flip side is I don't know what the right amount is. And in fact, I would say there isn't a right amount. But I think instead of just sitting on the money, hoping that it sits there until the second coming, and then I guess you use it however you use money during a 1,000-year period of peace or whatever. The church hopefully should be thinking about whether this is a good amount of money, what it could be doing with the money, what it should be doing with the money. And I wouldn't limit that to the church. I think that church members, tithe payers, and other stakeholders should be having the discussion that we're having right now about how much and why we should have these. And honestly, on a broader level, even for non-stakeholders in the LDS Church, I think society should be thinking about how much money is too much to just have sitting there tax-exempt without being used.
We can get into the details a little bit later, but Professor, since we're out of time, can I just ask you quickly, will the church lose its tax-exempt status? I'm guessing you say no.
The church won't lose its tax-exempt status. The biggest thing that could happen would be Ensign Peak Advisors losing its tax-exempt status.
That's Samuel Brunson, professor of law at Loyola University Chicago. His book is God and the IRS, Accommodating Religious Practice in the United States Tax Law. Professor, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Lee Hale, KUER's religion reporter. Lee, thanks again.
Thanks.
Radio West, a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We want to hear from you as well. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ale Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.